Shout out to US Soy and the United Soybean Board for supporting this episode of One Song, and for giving our podcast studio an unbelievably smooth, sustainable makeover. Here on our show, we dive deep into the music, dissecting every beat and lyric. Sustainability is just like that. Each eco-friendly choice we make is like a single note that contributes to life's melody. That's why Heartbeat and the USB are teaming up to lead the discussion around greening Hollywood. We're talking slashing the carbon footprint of production with soy-based alternatives like soy-based inks for printing scripts, soy foam for soundproofing studios, and even biodiesel generators to power sets. To see our sustainable studio transformation, watch the Tears for Fears episode of One Song and see behind-the-scenes clips of how we pulled the whole look together. It's all on at Heartbeat Audio on YouTube, and the link is in our show notes.
Myrtle Beach is the beach. 60 miles of bright sand, water, and a wealth of wonderful music playing day and night. You can step into a simple beach bar and discover a surprising level of exciting musical talent. A place to kick back and groove to the enticing soundtrack of the most unexpected vacations around. With nothing but good vibes floating through the warm ocean air. Plan your own music-filled trip to America's Jukebox at visitmyrtlebeach.com.
You're listening to One Song, very best podcast. We want you to listen to all these fun facts. If you want to know.
I don't have that part.
You don't know that part?
That part's too complicated. Okay, it's in E flat. I'm not that good of a keyboard player.
You know what? This is going to be one of the best episodes of One Song ever because we are doing it on the fly, much like the way that Stevie Wonder
Absolutely.
Recorded the seminal album Talking Book.
It is the One Song slop episode.
I am actor, writer, director, and sometimes DJ Diallo River.
And I'm producer, DJ, and songwriter Luxury, the guy who whispers interpolation on TikTok. This is an interesting episode because we're going to be talking about Stevie Wonder. But before we get into the song, there's something about this song and Stevie in general that we've been playing around with, like how it relates to the show in general, how the selection of the song, there's something we just kind of maybe want to kind of explain a little bit about the show and how the song
Absolutely. When we first started talking about this show, we talked about all the big artists and their, you know, huge catalog songs that we wanted to, you know, talk about, and one of them, you can't do a show about music without doing Stevie Wonder.
Iconic.
And at that point, we like looked at, you know, some of the Stevie Wonder songs you had the stems for, and we were like, oh, you got to do Superstition. That's a song that's like everywhere, you know, from weddings to like cool movies, you know, like it's a song that everybody knows. And it sort of led to this larger discussion of, can a perfect, you know, amazing song actually become a little bit played out, where you don't hear it as music anymore,
right?
And you're just like, oh, that's Stevie Wonder's Superstition, Aretha Franklin's Respect, that's Notorious B.I.G.'s, you know, Hypnotized. Like at some point that song really moves you, and then at some point later in your life, have you heard it
after
a billion times,
exactly.
It's just background
noise. It's kind of wallpaper, and it doesn't give you that same feeling anymore, at least when you think about it in theory. And one of the things that we want to do on this show is, first of all, that is the starting point for how we're selecting songs. They are iconic songs, iconic artists. You have heard them 1,000 times. But the whole point of the show is we're going to scrape off that like layer of rust on top that may have accumulated over the listens and the years, and you're going to hear the song completely differently after you listen to the episode, because we're going to play parts isolated, the stems. We're going to talk about how it came together and our emotional connection to the song.
And remind you of just how special the song actually is.
And hopefully after you hear the episode, the song will feel fresh again to
your
ears.
Like you won't associate it with your drunk uncle at that barbecue, you know, embarrassing himself.
Poor drunk uncle. Is there a specific drunk uncle that you have in mind when you bring up drunk uncle? Because drunk uncle makes a lot of cameos.
I actually only had one uncle, so people are going to really think I'm talking about Uncle Paul.
They know who it is.
But Uncle Paul, I love you. Rest in peace. You were sometimes you drank, but you were never that guy. You were never that uncle.
You're never that guy. Yeah. We love you, Uncle Paul.
All right, let's get into the Stevie song that we're going to break down in this episode. It's a tune that most people can identify within the first few seconds, mainly because of its instantly recognizable drum loop. And that's before we get to the clavinets. It is, of course, Superstition.
There is superstition.
When you believe in things that you don't understand, then you suffer. Well, we're going to help you understand.
Sounds familiar.
Well, we're going to help you understand how this song came about, how it was recorded, and how it's so unmistakably funky. But first, Diallo, I want to change it up a little and ask you a question.
Okay.
What is the best way to listen to Superstition? Is this a car song? Is it headphones when you're running, when you're strutting down the street with a boombox hoisted on your shoulder?
You know how I strut. That is, first off, I didn't know you were watching me that
close.
You got
some strutting technique.
And I do. I'm old school. I like to walk with a boombox over my shoulder because I like to keep people on their toes. I think it's a car song. I remember that was a big thing for Berry Gordy was like, you know, we make music for people to drive around in their cars too. And that was like a crazy thought at the time.
Yeah, that was the test. They would take the demo or the nearly finished version of the song, go in the car, like from the studio with the big fancy speakers, and then go sit in there like,
isn't that crazy?
Crappy Plymouth or whatever.
And the fact that it comes out of Detroit and Motown is, of course, a portmanteau of motor and town is just like, it all kind of works out. But yeah, I think this is actually a little bit more of like a cool sort of proto disco song, if I can, with that cool sort of, the line between funk and disco, at least in the classic sense, is very small. So
it's very thin. And 72 is kind of when you start having that crossover.
Absolutely.
Take place, right?
How about you, man? What do you think is the best way to listen to classic Stevie Wonder Superstition?
I got to be honest, as much as I'd like to be like a man of the streets and a man of the people, the fact that I have the isolated stems, which today we will be sharing, the answer is the isolated stems.
A man of the people with some stems.
I've got some special things, but I'm a sharer. And today we will be sharing with you the answer to your question, which to me, the best way to listen to a song, especially like Superstition, which we have heard a million times in the regular way, which is wonderful and awesome and wedding-esque at this point. It's like such a classic song you'll hear at a wedding. Hearing it isolated and broken down, just one component at a time, you're in the room with Stevie playing the drums, playing the clav, playing everything else. That to me is my favorite way to listen to Superstition.
Why don't you go ahead and put us in the room?
Let's do it. Let's get in the room with Stevie in 1972. Let's go there. So Superstition starts, as we all know, with that iconic drum intro. The drums are just...
Yeah.
He does a little pickup, a little fill.
The second you hear it, you know the song.
The second you hear it, you know exactly what you're about to hear. And that's really appropriate because that's actually the genesis of how the song was written. We'll talk about that in a minute, but first, let's hear that drum beat. It's just fun to listen to. I don't want to stop listening to you.
But we have to.
Do we have to move on? So, Diallo, what we just heard is... That's actually Stevie Wonder playing drums.
Dope.
One of the most underrated drummers of all time.
Yeah, I agree.
So there's a backstory to this song that I want to get into. It involves British guitar legend Jeff Beck, who passed away recently, and probably was the inspiration for Spinal Tap's Nigel Tufnel. If you ever see pictures of them side by side, it's the same guy. It starts with him coming into the Electric Lady Studios in New York.
Electric Lady, for the record... I know that Hendrix recorded there.
Right.
Is it just a place he recorded or did he own it?
I believe he had it built for him. And
oh, wow.
The album, Electric Ladyland, I think. I don't know which came first, actually. Chicken or the Egg was the album title or the studio name first. But it was Hendrix's studio. And actually, part of the backstory is that Hendrix was either on tour or just away from the studio. And that's part of how there was time for Stevie to come in and record this record.
Dope.
So getting back to the Superstition, the Jeff Beck story, Beck being the guitar legend that he was, he was a huge Stevie Wonder fan, by the way. He goes on to record 4 Stevie Wonder covers.
Yeah, I heard that it was like somebody reached out to Steve, was like, hey, Jeff Beck really likes your stuff and wants to record with you.
Big fan, and they were obviously mutual fans too, so they came together to write a song together for what would be Jeff Beck's next record. And Jeff sits down at the drums and starts playing that beat. Now, that wasn't him in the recording. The demo is unfortunately lost to time. I'd love to hear it. But he's playing that beat, and Stevie races in the room, and he's like, ding, 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 sits down at the keyboard, which is the clavinet keyboard. We're going to get into what that means in a moment.
Okay, because I was going to ask.
The importance of the clavinet and the sound, and starts playing the riff. in that moment. So we have the genesis of the song like within minutes and we're off to the races.
That's great.
Yeah. So keep in mind that this song was meant for Jeff Beck for his own record. And Stevie and Motown were like, sorry, guy.
They liked it too much.
Yeah.
That happens sometimes. Yeah. It's like, I feel like Prince has done that in a bunch of cases, like written something for somebody else.
Yeah. Yeah, with Kiss.
Point, he was like,
that's what
Kiss.
He did with Kiss,
yeah,
right? Kiss. That was for Maserati.
Well, but that was an example of somebody else preparing almost the whole song.
You're right. It's not an exact
and
match.
It was like, hey, Prince, what do you think? And then Prince is like, oh, I'm keeping this. That's a little bit different.
You're right.
I feel like here, okay, maybe the song was built around a beat, but, you know, to me, it sounds more like when Michael Jackson worked with Paul McCartney.
Right.
And they were like, hey, Paul, here's a song for you called The Girl Is Mine, and I want you to work on my song, Say, Say, Say. And then in maybe the one of the only bad decisions creatively Thriller album,
I totally agree.
They decided to put Say, Say, Say on Paul's album and The Girl Is Mine on Thriller.
Say, Say, Say is such an underrated banger.
Say, Say, Say is an amazing
song. It should have been on Thriller.
And it would have made Thriller one of the greatest albums of all time.
It would have been unskippable.
That much better.
It would have been unskippable.
By the way, that sort of like collaboration that has unexpected results, it happens all the time in comedy. I feel like there have been times when I've written a joke for somebody else and I'm like, ooh, this is too good.
You gotta keep this one.
I gotta keep this one in daddy's,
armory. Yeah, that's, I've done the same thing with music where I've like come up with a beat because that I'm intending to send to somebody else to write to, and I'm like, I'm gonna keep this in my back pocket it happens a lot with
it better
is
not
remixes.
Happen when we collaborate
it's
on music.
Not yet.
Like,
you've gotten
ooh,
all,
this is a little good
you've
for
gotten
one
all my
song.
Best.
Forget that show.
You get all my best. We get all my best. Yeah. I remember a quote from James Murphy actually that changed my mind about this because I used to be protective. Uh-huh. I was doing a remix and I'm like, oh, this is too good. I'm gonna keep it for myself. But his mentality or the way I read it was just like, you know, listen, remember you're always going to make more.
Yeah.
So just in that moment, it's for them. Just give it to them. Just let it go.
Totally.
And you'll make more good stuff later.
He's so like, I'll have my own house of jealous lovers.
Exactly. Exactly. And he did.
And he really did.
He really did. Before we get into the next section of the music, there is something really delicious throughout the drum section is how there's a bunch of fills and a bunch of parts that are really sloppy in the most like wonderful, exciting way. So I'm going to play that for you. Literally, it's funny. Like, I think he was laughing as he played that. He's like, this is crazy. And it's like a wonderful mess. But it's like, it's also funky. Like,
I think it's because, like, as he's playing his drums, he's thinking about, like, ooh, and then the harmonica could go like this.
That's so true. Because what's interesting about Stevie is he starts recording usually not on the drums.
Right.
Like, this is a rare example where he is recording the drums first, but he is in his head thinking about the rest of the song. So he's building what's going to come next.
I'm so glad you brought that up. I think funk is always at its best when it's percussive and when it's rhythm driven. And I think that might be why this song was probably crafted in no ways like signed, sealed, delivered. You know
right,
what I mean?
Right.
Like, it's one of those things that's like, you know, and also let's just say something about in the business, it's called the Stevie slop. You know, like, it's like, no, technically, this kind of goes towards what we were saying about Ringo Starr almost in another episode of this show. Sometimes the drums don't have to be technically perfect to be fantastic.
Right.
And I think that there's something about the fact that it is imperfect that loans, it makes the whole song more vibey. I mean, like, it really, I think it was Robert Glasper who said he had to play, like, you know, part of this song while Stevie was there.
And Stevie insisted on making him play the clown
part. Yeah, and he was like, Stevie, I really think you should play this part. And he was like, no, man, go ahead and do it.
Yeah.
And, of course, he's like, I don't know how to do it because it's actually harder to nail imperfection sometimes.
Yeah. And it's so specific to Stevie's body. Like, it's just him and how he's emoting in that moment. Like, you can't replicate that performance exactly. It's not possible.
Drums are the structure in a lot of ways of most songs. And I think that when you can do them in sort of a sloppy way, like, I think about like how Dilla's beat is always a little bit behind where you think it should technically be. If you told AI or the computer to put the drum beat here, like, you know, that's what makes it human.
That's such an interesting tension in funk as a genre too, because it's simultaneously about like tautness of a beat that is an infectious groove, and there's repetition, and there's sort of like a droney quality to it. But there's also these, like, you have to pepper that with these kind of, with the Stevie slot, basically. I kind of want to use that now in general to mean the kind of magic sauce you sprinkle on top to make it interesting and kind of beyond the grid.
So there you go, Stevie Wonder. We want to associate your name with slop. More on Superstition after the short break. Shout out to U.S. Soy and the United Soybean Board for supporting this episode of One Song, and for giving our podcast studio an unbelievably smooth, sustainable makeover. Here on our show, we dive deep into the music, dissecting every beat and lyric. Sustainability is just like that. Each eco-friendly choice we make is like a single note that contributes to life's melody. That's why Heartbeat and the USB are teaming up to lead the discussion around greening Hollywood. We're talking slashing the carbon footprint of production with soy-based alternatives like soy-based inks for printing scripts, soy foam for soundproofing studios, and even biodiesel generators to power sets. To see our sustainable studio transformation, watch the Tears for Fears episode of One Song and see behind-the-scenes clips of how we pulled the whole look together. It's all on at Heartbeat Audio on YouTube, and the link is in our show notes.
A lot can happen between falling in love with a house online and owning it. Between imagining living there and breathing in your new home for the first time. Having an advocate who can help you navigate the complex world of financing, inspections, negotiating, analyzing the market, and talking through any anxieties that may pop up, that can make all the difference. That's what the expertise of a Realtor can do for you. Realtors are members of the National Association of Realtors and bound by a code of ethics. Because that's who we are.
Start clean with Clorox, because Clorox delivers a powerful clean every time. Because messes happen. Because...
Hey, listen. Remember how you told me to toss those takeout containers before we left for vacation? And you were like, I'm serious. If that leaks over the counter, it'll be a slimy abomination by the time I get back. And I was like, yeah. Of course. Don't worry about it. I won't forget. Well...
Ooh, yeah. That happens. So start clean with Clorox. Use Clorox products as directed. Rinse after use if in contact with food surface.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
So we have the drums down, and what happened next? Remember, this is Stevie Wonder with Jeff Beck in the studio. Jeff has just played the drums, although what we heard was Stevie recording them later. But what happened next was Stevie sat down at an instrument called the clavinet, which is pretty critical for the Stevie Wonder story. Now, remember, this is 1972.
Yeah.
He's just recently been released from his previous Motown contract. He's still with Motown, but it's a completely different deal.
Yeah.
He's completely on his own.
And I heard a lot of, like, you know, regular white record labels were all coming to Stevie. He was like, no, I'm going back to Motown, but I'm going to have it be on my terms.
But I got a new deal. Yeah. I own my own publishing.
I'm not using any of Barry's songwriters and producers. Right. I'm doing my own thing.
Total creative freedom. And this instrument, the clavinet, just to explain what it is, it is the sound of Stevie Wonder, 70s Stevie Wonder. It's a sound associated with, there's other songs that use it, and I'll play them for you in a second, but it is so specifically as an instrument tied to him, and possibly because of this song in particular. And I'm going to play for you the isolated clav parts and talk about the Stevie slop. Oh my God, the clav is crazy town, but just you wait. Let's hear it. So that's the iconic riff that we all recognize.
On the clavinet.
On the clavinet.
Now let me ask you, because I feel like not everyone listening will know what a clavinet is. I mean, some of our people were like, oh, I didn't know Stevie played the clarinet. Like, it's like, no, it's a clavinet.
The clavinet, is a keyboard.
Please explain the instrument.
Yeah, the clavinet is a keyboard manufactured by the Hohner, company.
Shout out to Hohner.
Shout out to Hohner. It's different from, say, the Rhodes or the Whirly. These are other very popular keyboards of the time, because those are instruments where when you hit a key, it hits the string and then it kind of vibrates. Mm-hmm. So what you have is like dynamics. You can be loud, you can be soft. the clavinet is always the same dynamic because it's actually plucking a string, like you would pluck a harp. Mm. And in fact, it's related. It's not dissimilar to the harpsichord, which, by the way, I can play for you if you...
I was going to say, I associate that with like the British monarchy.
Right, like... like... But if you'll hear the similarity...
Lord Stevie Wonder, where have you found this strange instrument?
Those notes are all kind of even duration, and that's the same with... And what's interesting about that is that when you're a little messy on it, it evens it out a little bit because at least all the sounds coming are the same. So your timing can be a little crazy. You can
is it auto-tune for keyboardists?
It's a little bit like auto-tune for a keyboard because check this out. There's also a second line of clavinets, which I'll play for you now. This is crazy on its own, but just you wait till you hear it together with the first one. By the way, I should point out that in spite of what I just explained, something magical about Stevie's fingers is that he does find a way to get a little bit of dynamics in there. There is a little bit of a soft, loud range that he's finding. I do not know how to do that. I am not the clav god that Stevie Wonder is. But now check this out in the mix with that first
clav god
main riff. Here are all eight clavinets going at once, which they do throughout the song.
I mean, that is insane levels insane. Of complex.
That is finding so many different syncopated
it's like,
pockets.
It's like
to
you're
fill.
Being hit by like funky gunfire from every direction. And you know, this kind of goes towards the heart of the episode is because like this song, Stevie Wonder as an artist, the word funky used to mean something good. Like, in my lifetime, these have all been like the corniest things. Like if somebody says, oh, I like those shoes. Those are really funky. Like you're just like oh man, you are the oldest old man on the planet. But there was a time when funk was where all the innovation was. I mean, it's just like if, you know, you look, you know, you go into the future and it's like, oh, you have a tech company? Good for you, old man. You know, like it's just like it's weird to see how these things change over time.
Right.
But that is amazing. I mean, I can't believe that there's that much complexity in what he's doing.
Right. And all the interlocking parts, and there are eight different clav sounds happening at once that you hear. And as we play them isolated, you can kind of find your way to what's happening one at a time. Once you mix them, it becomes crazy town. But then when you go back to those drums, which remember were also themselves Stevie Slop, somehow it starts to connect in a way that's like magic. I can't think of a better word. Because that just fits. It does everything you want it to do. Nothing more, nothing less.
I have to say that, like, this is one of my favorite things that I think we explore on this show is when an artist has such a clear idea of where they want to go that they have to invent an instrument to get there. Right. Like there are a couple of episodes where I feel like, you know, so-and-so had to create it. Like I heard that when he came, this instrument was put together by like one of his producers, one of his session players, and like it weighed a ton. Like so, it was like a bunch of different machines.
Let's talk
all
about what's
tied
going
together.
On here.
Is that true?
So what you're referring to actually is a completely new invented creation. It was a one-off called Tonto, which is a room filled with synthesizers that were connected that was created by these two guys, Malcolm Cecil and Robert Margalef, who were Stevie's producer on this record and the three that followed, part of his classic period.
Oh, wow. Those include Music of My Mind,
Talking Book, right?
Inner Visions.
Love that record,
We got to tackle Inner Visions at some point. It's one of my favorites. Yeah. And The Fulfillingness is first finale.
Which has one great song on it. But then they stop right before Songs in the Key of Life.
Which is another great one. But
But these two guys had this brilliant idea. Because don't forget, at the time, synthesizers are brand new. They're very expensive. They're very difficult to operate. They're huge. They're enormous. And Stevie's not just looking for a new way of making music. He wants new sounds. He wants new ideas. So
that's great.
He hears about these guys because they put out a record actually as Tonto. If you go back and listen to 1971, it's kind of an experimental synthy record. He hears this record. He loves this record. Tracks them down. And they put him in Electric Lady in a room in a circle. All of the synthesizers are connected. And the reason why that's really significant is it's kind of the beginning of something we now take for granted, which is one person sitting down with all the sounds instantly available to them to make music.
Yeah.
Don't forget, before you had to like plug stuff in, you had to tune it. All these things that are complicated, not to mention the studio itself. This is really revolutionary. And Stevie is the first to take advantage of it and become sort of template of the modern producer.
He's one of these guys who can play so many different instruments. Right. So yeah, it's everything set up for one person.
That combination of he can play the instruments and all the instruments are there. You know, when you think of Lenny Kravitz later and obviously Prince, it's Stevie was arguably the first to really have that situation in place. And not unimportantly, these sounds are new and weird. That's something we forget with our modern ears.
Totally.
But these synthesizers, the Moog bass, which we'll play in a second, that was a completely mind-blowingly new. There's deeper bass, you know, frequencies that you couldn't get before.
I think one thing about this album, even more than most albums from the 70s, it actually still sounds kind of modern.
Yes.
You know, like the way I always assumed it was the way that it was mastered, but you're right. The sounds that he was creating sound more like a more recent. Like, you could have made this, this could be, some of these songs could be D'Angelo songs from, like, the late 90s in sense that, like, they sound more modern than most songs that, most albums that came out.
That's a great connection, too, because just thinking about, like Voodoo, like, that record is consciously, it's very dry.
Yeah.
And this record and these producers consciously tried to make things very dry. And we had, on a previous episode, we talked about Amy Winehouse and that big reverb-y, that's a very 60s sound, the wall of sound, the Phil Spector reverb and all this. They did the opposite. This is a very dry record. And I think to our modern ears, that sounds very modern, that you don't have all those effects on.
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons why it's had such a long life at weddings and movie trailers, because
it doesn't feel dated.
It doesn't sound as dated.
Yeah.
So is Superstition an example of Tonto?
You know, on this record, it's kind of the least Tonto-y, because it's really just the clav.
Yeah.
And the drums, and there's horns obviously too, and there's Moog bass, which I'm about to talk about. But it is technically, those are components, rather the two keyboards are components of this giant 6 foot tall, 20 foot long series of machines, which is what Tonto is. Yeah, which weighs
a ton. Talk to me about the Moog.
So let's get into the Moog. Now, Moog, by the way, is spelled M-O-O-G, and now that you've heard this, a lot of people think it's pronounced Moog.
Oh, I thought it was up until you just said Moog.
Now we're all insiders in the Robert Moog story. The Moog was it was the bass in this song, not a bass guitar, and I'm going to play that for you. And that's what I was just referring to a moment ago. There are some frequencies that are like you can't get on a bass guitar with the production of the era, but you could get it. You can feel it in your stomach because it's this Moog synth playing the bass line. It's like a bouncy ball. And there's some sounds, like the bounciness. You can't get that bounciness on a bass guitar.
Woo!
That's special.
I'm reminded of Ohio Players' Funky Worm.
Anything Parliament is going to be Bernie Worrell.
Seriously. I don't like the word funky, but I like the things that funky describes.
I couldn't agree more. It's a great word, but there's something about it that feels, it's like saying groovy or something.
Oh, it's so like, musty. It feels like musty. You brought it out of the closet with a polyester suit. It's just the worst.
It's dank, it's dusty, it's free.
It was
fresh.
Subversive.
Subversive and fresh.
It was like, oh man, that's funky.
In 1972, when this came out, that was, you could not get funkier than that rubbery bass line. It's like all, it's like simultaneously like everything else in the song. It's all over the place. It's a huge mess. And yet somehow the tightest thing you've ever heard.
Absolutely.
How does that, I don't understand that.
You have
it's
to be
magic.
Able to hold two conflicting ideas in your head at once. So you put all these elements together and it creates one of the greatest, most memorable all-time riffs.
Right.
Of all time.
Yeah.
Real quick, because I've been a singer, I've been a drummer like you.
Yeah.
Let's get on the same page. How would you define riff?
Riff is such like a magic word, because what it means literally is just a repeated series of notes that has kind of as a repetition, a hypnotic quality that it kind of starts to compete with maybe what the vocal melody would be for what the song is in your mind. So like a perfect example of that would be like Led Zeppelin, you know, Whole Lot of Love, da-na-na-na-na. People sing that as much as Whole Lot of Love, if not more so, when you think of the song. The repeated element, by the way, the overlap between like what makes something a riff and what makes it just a funky bass line is really thin.
Mm.
Like, in a way, the Superstition riff is, you know, the bass is kind of also playing it sometimes, but like it's not a bass line, it's a riff. A riff is kind of like next tier. It's like this special type of melody, type of repetition that just, it earworms you. It digs its way into your...
That's so interesting. Now, listen, we're both music nerds, okay?
We both are.
I'm gonna call an audible and put you on the spot.
Okay.
Give me your favorite top three riffs of all time.
Almost a perfect riff to me is... you know what it is? I'm hesitating to say it because it's so obvious.
Go for it.
I think one of the greatest riffs of all time is I Can't Get No Satisfaction.
Yeah.
It's just...
Go for it.
Impossible. And it's the simplicity of it.
And by the way,
oh my God,
for listeners,
yeah,
for our listeners, real fun fact about that song is that the Beatles label heard that song and they were like, "Can you guys give us a song like that Stone song?" And then the Beatles did "Day Tripper."
Oh no way! Yeah. I have no idea. Which is another
which is a great
that's,
riff.
Maybe that's my number two riff of all time.
That was
Thank you for helping me answer the question. And that also another fun fact about that is that that was intended to be in Keith's mind, that was a horn riff. That was meant to be like a Motown thing. Yeah.
Wow, that's awesome.
But on the guitar was plenty. And obviously adding that fuzz, that super fuzz on the guitar. And maybe I'm going to go back to the Kinks for one more because I'm a huge Kinks fan. You just can't beat... What technically might even be the first guitar riff per se, because it's ostensibly the invention of distortion, is when Dave Davies from the Kinks takes a knife and rips the speaker to get that sound that we hear, and you really got me. So that's got to be up there. Those are my top three.
Those are great. Yeah. Those
what
are
about
great.
You?
Oh, no, you can't ask me.
Oh. You helped me with number two, so that was a collaborative list.
You know what's crazy? I'm going to go avant-garde here. I'm going to try and do, because it would be very easy for me being, you know, a big fan of disco. I feel like disco gives you so many great riffs.
Yeah.
So many great riffs. But I'm going to go with, I'm going to try and do all hip-hop. I'm going to do The Choice Is Yours by Black Sheep.
Oh, yeah. I love that bass line. Is that a bass line or a riff, though? See, that's what I was saying before.
Well, but see, that's why I think to talk about riffs...
Do you go away singing that as the song in your head?
A little bit.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
In my head. But let's see, by your use of the definition, then A Millie by Lil Wayne is a riff.
I am very open-minded with
definitions. It's word sampled.
I'm never going to be a fascist about it.
It's serving the same purpose. Are you saying a riff has to be a guitar?
So here's what I would say. I'm not a fascist about anything, but especially about definitions.
I thought we interviewed you before you took this position, and it clearly says, are you a fascist?
My authoritarian tendencies are a little bit sus, I understand.
Don't get political now.
As a Virgo, I do tend to have some control. Okay, but besides that, my organization and control are connected, right? Where's
the
line?
You feel like a riff has to be a guitar?
Here's what I'm going to say. Here's where I go. There's a word cloud.
Uh-huh.
There's riff. There's bass line. There's ostinato, which is like the classical version of it where you've got a repeated melodic element and then the chords change underneath it. That's kind of what a riff can be sometimes. So these things can have connected elements. And last but not least to your question about A Millie, I would say that a sample serves an incredibly similar function
where it's
repeated, but it's underneath the main thing. That's what to me a riff really is. It's a repeated element, but it's underneath the main thing.
Well, half the time I use the word riff, I'm in comedy. That's just like, hey, you got to stall for time. Yeah. Hey, just get out there and riff. Just means you have no script, which we don't know about on this show because there's always a very tight script on this show.
Very tight.
But I think that the A Millie sample, the bass line of The Choice Is Yours, I think these serve the same purposes of I Can't Get No Satisfaction. But just to placate resident fascist luxury, I'm going to say...
Is that my new intro?
I'm going to say...
DJ, producer...
I'm resident fascist.
And tyrant.
And local tyrant. I'm going to say, just to pick a guitar that... you know, I kind of think it's a riff in a Boogie Oogie Oogie. By Taste of Honey. Yeah.
I think it's a bass line, but here's what I'll give you. In the spirit of collaboration and yes-anding, I think it's all the umbrella is.
You really think it has to be a riff has to be the guitar?
I mean, that's what I'm saying about I'm not a fascist. It's like, okay, yeah, technically the relationship is there. But when, to me, the thing that's different is there is something about a repeated element that is in the bass register.
Right.
It serves a different function. And the repetition of it can...
All right,
the register matters because it's more body, and a riff is more head. It's closer to the vocal register, so it acts more like a melody, I think, to your brain. That's science right there.
I'm going to go with...
That is science.
I'm going to go with bam, bam. Bam, bam, bam. Bam, bam, bam.
Wait, what's that?
Let's go crazy.
Bum, bum. That's a riff. That's a riff.
I hope you're happy.
We agree. Oh, that's your answer.
Yeah.
You brought it full circle. That's a great answer, and I kind of wish I had it. So if we can collaborate on the whole thing, those are our top four. Are we shared on the top four? We don't have to share.
No, we're not even talking
anymore. I'm trying to be so collaborative. Okay, so where I want to go next is the vocals.
Okay.
This is Stevie Wonder in the raw, Superstition.
When you believe in things that you don't understand, then you suffer. Superstition anyway.
Yeah, you know, first off, so much. I love the Stevie growl.
That growl, like, is so satisfying.
Like, you know, like, I like it when he growls. I like so the Stevie satisfying. Growl. Also, what a voice. I mean, like, this is the reason why I feel like nobody has ever... There's certain artists that I feel like artists should almost never cover, because you can't sing as good as them.
You can't
sing as well. Sorry, grammarians. You can't sing as well as Stevie Wonder. It's hard to cover Michael Jackson or Aretha Franklin. There's just some people. Now, I will say there are, you know, a handful of Stevie Wonder covers that I think are as good and maybe surpass the original.
Okay.
You know, we could talk about
it. Shots fired.
But no shots fired. I mean, like, literally... You don't want to go after Stevie Wonder.
Yeah, it's
just not done. Those vocals, amazing.
And by the way, if you like the growl, you might love the scream at 2 minutes and 30 seconds. Here it is.
I think I know what part you're playing.
He's having fun in the studio.
Oh, my gosh.
He is letting loose. He is a free man. He's got control. He's got a bank. He's got a circle, a room with a circle of new sounds and instruments.
He can play all these instruments.
Yep.
And he can growl and scream and run. Stevie's runs are so buttery.
Oh,
they are so buttery.
Yeah,
I mean, like,
stretching out those notes.
Superstition in my own lifetime, it's like one of those songs. Sometimes it becomes like wallpaper. It becomes background noise.
Right.
But then when you hear his vocals, you realize this is masterful.
The magic is in the vocals.
It deserves all the success it got.
Absolutely. A couple more just little fun moments, just because, again, when you hear the isolated vocals, you really are it's like a time machine. You go back, you're in the room in 1972 when this was recorded, and you feel the fun in the room. So here's another fun moment.
That sounds like somebody else we know.
We were just talking about funkiness. And runs.
There are about five songs in just that humming. I mean, so many songs inside this guy's brain. I would just like to take that humming and build a whole song over that.
That's all you need.
I want to take that humming and just Jeff Beckett.
And that's cutting room floor stuff there. I mean, that's like, I don't even know if that made it to the final, because that's in the fade out. So, like, you know, when you record a song, obviously, you can't fade all the instruments out, but in the recording, it goes like this. But you play until you stop. One of my favorite things to do, by the way, when we have fade out songs, is to actually hear what the end of the song
sounds like. Oh, absolutely.
Let's do that real quick. This is the actual ending of Superstition. Unheard until this moment. That big mess, because it's Stevie doing each layer, and he's like, oh shoot, my drums just stopped. I guess I got to stop playing the Moog now. And then the horns are like, oh, I guess the song just ended.
I thought it actually sounded really cool how, like, so much dropped out, but then, like, there was still, like, a little bit of melody still in there. That was great.
Little remnant sound.
Yeah.
If that was a James Brown tune, it'd be like, you're all fired. All you Stevies are all fired.
Absolutely.
No tightness there in the conclusion.
Let's talk about the lyrics to Superstition. Now, when I was young, this I don't know that I really understood it at all. You know, I was like, what, 13-month-old baby? Like, what's we were all 13 months at some point, I'm going to assume.
Yeah. And isn't that a toddler anyway, or an infant?
I mean, like, you know, is that really a baby at really that point? Baby. I mean, like, that child should be maybe one word in.
We'll let it go.
By that point.
We'll let it
go. But we'll let that go. I mean, like, literally, it was a matter of, I don't know that I even understood what the song was about. Mm-hmm. You know, I knew what a superstition was, obviously, but, you know, so much of it, right before the break, I mentioned, like, wash your face and hands. Like, I just didn't get it. Yeah. And then later I was like, oh, well, you know, Stevie is religious. And so he was saying superstition is bad because it's, you know, it kind of goes against Christian beliefs. You know, it's
yeah.
most superstitions, I think, probably have a pretty pagan origin. But now I think about it, and I keep coming back to that line that you mentioned at the top of the show, which is when you believe in things you don't understand.
You suffer.
You suffer. Yeah. And I feel like that can be more universal than anything.
That's,
I mean, like, in some weird ways,
profound, yeah.
You could make the case that that goes against a lot of organized religion, that goes against, you know, political organizations, like,
right.
You know, it can mean a lot of things. And I think in that meaning a lot of things, it can be a more universal message.
I totally agree. And I have to say that I suppose I have some awareness of Stevie's religious affiliation,
yeah.
But to me, this song, to your point, feels like anti any sort of authoritative, structurally driven, like,
right.
belief system.
Right.
So that could be, you know, I suppose superstition is the opposite of it being structural, but it's any belief system that doesn't, in which you don't fully understand what the rules are. If you don't fully understand what's going on, but you just take it in on faith.
Listening to this song, I didn't fully understand what was going on.
Like, right.
You know, I always thought the chorus was superstition leads the way. You know, until we started prepping this episode.
Yeah.
So, you know, it just kind of goes to show that sometimes the best art is open to interpretations.
Open interpretations.
Interpolation? Interpretations, but I know you could pay for the usage of the word.
I get paid by the interpolation committee.
Do you have any superstitions?
I used to. I think one part of my recent self-esteem journey, honestly, like, I'm connecting those two. I really am. Like, therapy, self-esteem, all this stuff has been to not have fears that are unfounded in, like, you know, that you don't understand by this presumption of there being this something that you're, like, in danger of upsetting in the world. Like, there's something in Buddhism called wisdom fear, which is when you're at the corner and there's, like, a red light and there are cars coming. Wisdom fear is, if you go, you'll get hit. That kind of fear is good.
Yeah.
Wisdom fear is, there's a situation that I'm going to be careful of.
Yeah.
But the lack, like, not wisdom fear would be, like, the type of thing where it's like, well, I can't get out of the shower until, like, you know, some sort of system you have in your head.
I can't walk under this ladder.
Or exactly right. These, like, typical superstitions or sort of things that you create in your mind as rules out of fear.
Okay, well, I'll tell you, I recently became aware of the fact that I full on have a superstition.
What is it?
It is splitting the pole. And have you ever heard of splitting the pole?
No, what does that mean?
Okay, so this is another thing. I think this might be a Black or Southern thing, because I was asking people about it, and a lot of people have not heard about it. But when you're walking somewhere, and there's, like, let's say there's, like, a sign, you know, like, on a pole.
Is it when you're with somebody else?
Yeah, when you're walking with somebody,
yeah.
And you walk on opposite sides of that signpost or that opposite size of that lamppost, that... Growing up, that was always where I grew up, in Atlanta, Georgia, predominantly Black Southwest Atlanta. That was called splitting the pole. And, like, recently I was walking somewhere with my kids, and he walked on the other side of the pole. I was like, you get back around
that
pole.
That's so interesting.
You go back around
that
pole.
I've never heard that
expression.
Otherwise,
our souls will be separated for all eternity.
Okay, that's blowing my mind a little bit, because I didn't have the expression, but where I grew up in San Francisco, the Bay Area of California, we didn't call it that, but the idea, what you had to do if you were with somebody and there was something coming, you'd have to say bread and butter.
What?
I swear to God, we call that bread and butter. And that's how you get over the problems potentially caused by not saying bread and butter.
Oh, so it's like a knock on wood or something like that.
It's just
so you guys can actually walk on the other sides of the pole.
Just as long as you say the phrase that pays,
as long as you say,
which is bread and butter.
And butter.
And similar to that, you are supposed to say the last thing you say when you go to bed at the end of the month, on, like, January 31st, before February 1st, the last thing you say, you're supposed to say hair, hair. And then the first thing you say when you wake up is rabbit, rabbit. So you're bringing this all back.
Lord, that is so complicated.
So complicated. And you have to do it 12 times a year. It's actually 24
the things
events.
You learn.
You have to do 24 things all year. Like, so that
you
was
You don't
part
do
of,
any of this anymore.
I don't do it. It's been a long time since I did these things, but I just remembered that I did have them in my life.
And you're not suffering anymore.
And I'm not suffering
And you're
anymore,
not suffering. No. Meanwhile, my kids better not split the poll.
No. If they're listening.
If my wife splits
guys,
the poll,
no poll
I'm
poll.
Like, you go back.
You redo.
And by the way, sometimes you're with like multiple people. So like, once you realize you split a poll, you had, which side of the poll did you go? Like, it becomes very complicated. Sometimes
you have to
I'll
redo
just walk
it exactly
back.
The same
sometimes
way.
I'll just walk back.
You have to reset.
It's easier that way.
Okay.
It's
what are the consequences
easier.
Of splitting the poll?
Your souls are separated for eternity.
That's what blew my mind, because like I think implicit in the bread and butter story was some kind of equally horrible fate, but it wasn't ever explicitly mentioned to that.
No,
debate.
Your souls are separated. And I'd like to see my kids. So we're coming to the end of this episode about Stevie Wonder's superstition. You know, one thing that we always wanted to do when we set out to do this show was talk about songs that we loved, but also songs that are just out there
yes.
in the universe. And this is one of those songs, I think when we first started talking about this specific song, we were like, oh, is that song, like, you know, is it played out?
Right.
Is it something that we've heard to? Like,
it's always the line we're trying to
figure out. Absolutely love this song.
Yeah.
Like, and I think that one thing that we landed on is that it's so important to understand why some of these songs have managed to stay out there.
Right.
And can you talk a little bit about that? And also Stevie's legacy. Like, I think the other thing that we were agreed was
right.
that there are artists that I think you and I kind of like love more
right.
than Stevie. But I think when you take a step back and look at Stevie's catalog, it is amazing. Let's
yeah.
talk about his legacy.
Well, when you say that, I think of two things. One, just personally, because my experience of hearing this song was like I think a lot of people, like at some point, the Sesame Street episode where they're playing Superstition and it's just mind-blowingly like, it just taps into all of the good feelings, all of the like, you know, tingly yeah. tinglies. Part of that though, is because I think there are different time periods where when you hear stuff, it impacts you in different ways.
Yeah.
And when you are a preteen and it's not, you're not fully aware of what the song is, for example, and maybe years later you hear it, and because you heard it in that moment, it becomes like this Rosebud or like the Proustian Madeleine. Like it just evokes nostalgia and you can't put your finger on it, which is a little different than when you're a teenager and you kind of get
right.
your music and it's a tribal thing and it's the friends.
And it's part of your identity.
It's part of your identity.
Yeah.
It's part of the experiences. We went to Taylor Swift together and there's these sort of social reasons behind it.
Yeah, yeah,
so
yeah.
for me, this song taps into that first area of like it's lodged in the brain pleasure center somewhere and will never be
yeah,
removed.
I think it's so important, you know, like we try to take sort of a positive spin on most of these songs, and I think that it's so important to remember that even if Stevie Wonder is not like the artist that it's not, if you talk to people our age and younger, he's not always the first artist that pops to mind. Who's your favorite artist?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But I think it's important to hear these songs the way that they were heard when they were first released, before they got in every movie
when they were still fresh
and wedding
sounding.
Yeah. I mean, like growing up, I will even say like my favorite Stevie Wonder song was not Superstition or Sir Duke or I Wish. You know, they're those songs in the Stevie canon.
Yeah.
Science Hill Delivered. Those weren't my favorite. My favorite was probably Ribbon in the Sky, which is like a super R&B,
wow.
you know.
Deeper cut, frankly.
But if that's the thing, it wasn't a deep cut.
For you.
If you're growing up in an all-black school in
okay.
Atlanta, you know what I'm saying?
Well, ribbons in the sky for our love.
Stevie has that catalog.
But that's actually kind of part of what we're talking about. There's something about the artists for whom there was a shorter period of time that they made music. Like the Beatles only made music, only recorded for 7 years.
Yeah.
And therefore they benefit a little bit in our consciousness.
Yeah, you can actually know every Beatles
from the
song
scarcity.
Because it's so
it's limited.
Small. And then like
that's
sometimes
right.
when I think about Stevie Wonder, I'm like, what about Skeletons? That song from like the late 80s, you know what I mean? Like
yes, we talk about Stevie's like that run of albums that he's at the beginning of
yeah.
with Superstition, and that's his classic period. But then 45 more years went by after Songs in the Key of Life.
Right.
And I haven't heard all that music. And I another like Prince is another example of that. I don't know all the Prince music.
A lot of us were not buying Prince albums in 2003.
Yeah,
You know, Musicology was almost like a comeback for him.
So
even that was like it didn't carry him all the way to 2014. I would be at the shows,
no.
but like you know, yeah.
It feels a little unfair to say that, like to be a living legend and an icon who makes it to 72, makes it to 80,
yeah.
almost does something momentarily detrimental. Not detrimental. I know what the word is, but it puts the catalog into a different category.
It's
whereas
whole,
if you're Joy Division or Nirvana, you benefit, or Notorious B.I.G. There's something about
there's always been something sexy about leaving the sexy corpse, in music. Yeah. And you know, I always say, like, imagine if Michael Jackson, you know, Biggie dies on the eve of the release of Life After Death. Imagine if Michael Jackson died on the eve of the release of Bad, or even Dangerous, right. or it's just something before all the issues that he had in the 90s and the 2000s.
Right.
Like, people would talk about him as a deity. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, you know, it would
and
just
this doesn't
be
feel
seen
fair.
As,
like, we're not saying that this is a good thing. It's just like it's an interesting.
Yeah, it's not
kind
really
of,
fair.
It doesn't feel fair.
When David
Stevie
Bowie died,
deserves,
I was like listening to all the David Bowie stuff from like the 70s and the 80s, maybe a little bit of the 60s, but like, you know, very few people were picking up his albums from, like, I'm sure he had an album in 2010 or 2011.
Yeah.
You know, but
it's an interesting phenomenon. Yeah.
I was just going to say, for the record, Stevie Wonder, we're happy you're alive.
Oh, absolutely.
We want to celebrate that. And we want to give you your flowers right now.
But
while you're still with us.
This is more of a cultural thing, I think. We there's youth and currency is obviously a big part of what drives the culture to the detriment of the icons who live to continue to make their art, their music, write their books, whatever it is. They're kind of locked in this maybe zone where they had their initial burst of creativity on the scene or some innovation or whatever it is. And I think, I'm not sure if that's a product of just how the culture works or how the world works, but Stevie Wonder deserves to be. I'm glad
to be in that pantheon.
I'm glad we pulled back the layers on this song and were reminded, both you and I personally, of how amazing it is.
Of the genius of Stevie Wonder. Yeah. And with that in mind, the last thing I want to talk about here is how Stevie's songs are kind of ubiquitous.
Yes.
You know, in the culture, at weddings, we said at weddings, movie trailers, and all that kind of thing. I can't remember the last time I was at a wedding that didn't have at least one Stevie jam. But I don't want to talk about those songs. I want to talk about those Stevie songs. They can be on Talking Book or something else that really means, like, what is your favorite obscure or like that Stevie Wonder song that you don't think enough people know about? And let's give it a platform right now. What is your Stevie Wonder song that isn't the Stevie Wonder wedding song? I really love You Got a Bad Girl. Like, to me, that is Stevie sort of inventing the sort of, like, jazz fusion that's going to be so prominent in R&B music in the mid to, you know, late 70s. Like, if you just think about how the chords start off on that song, the... You notice I hummed it, and I'm not going to sing it because, again, nobody wants to try and sing like Stevie Wonder unless you can really blow. But, like, that chord construction, like, it hits me every time. And then it goes, you got it bad, girl. Like, it
I love
you talk
that.
Of chills,
that.
Like,
no, that
one. Song, You Got It Bad, Girl, is so dope to me.
Yeah.
Like, it just sounds so good. And that's not a song that I feel like, you know, I would love it. And so it's like, hey, man, can you play some Stevie Wonder? And then I put on You Got a Bad Girl to, like, bring the dance floor to a complete stop. Like, that would make... But I think that, like, nobody can do those complex jazz structured chords like
jazz,
Stevie.
It's jazz, it's funk, it's pop all at once. Yeah, it's R&B.
Exactly. He took jazz and kind of made it pop friendly, which by the 70s is already becoming a little unheard of.
You Are the Sunshine of My Life, like right out the gate you get these crazy chord changes. It's like, and this is pop radio, and this is melodic, and it's instantly accessible, you know, the lyric and everything, but there's jazz happening under the surface.
There absolutely is.
Which is, I mean, stealth
that
jazz.
That one in particular, I feel like that one is...
harmonically speaking.
It, that one feels like Burt Bacharach to me, in the best way.
No, that's a great...
Did I pronounce his name right?
Is it Bacharach?
Okay, cool.
Great comparison.
Yeah, like, You Are the Sunshine of My Life, like, there's a lightness and there's an air flowing through it that, you know, I think that's the best way for me to describe it.
Yeah.
But there's something, like, smoky jazz club mysterious fun...
Smoky, that's good.
...about... You Got It Bad.
It's like that blood orange. It's like a little bit like harshness that makes it more special. Do you know what I mean?
It is
like,
direct-to-table music.
Farm-to-table.
Farm-to-table jazz. You can tell I don't eat organic.
Instagram
I can't afford
jazz.
That. Organic food is always the most expensive.
By the way, I got an answer for you.
What is your answer?
I don't know how much of a deep cut it is, but my favorite Stevie Wonder song is probably Love Having You Around.
Wow.
Every day I want to ride my bike, boom, boom. I'll get on my camel and ride.
Ride, baby. And when the day is through, nothing to do, I just sit around.
That's my favorite one.
I'm gonna be honest here. I don't know that song.
I love that track. That's on Music of My Mind.
Okay.
And
I'm gonna go listen to it. And what's the other one?
My second favorite, and this is a little bit of a cheat because it's a Stevie written song, but not performed by, and that would absolutely be, and it's neck and neck with the other one I said for number one, but Tell Me Something Good by
Rufus
featuring
Rufus.
Chaka Khan.
He wrote that?
He wrote that.
Tell me something good.
And it's got the clav on it, by the way.
For real?
That's in like the top seven of all time songs for me, period.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
What are some other songs that have the clav?
There's a few good songs you want to talk about.
I heard Machine Gun, one of my favorite Commodore songs. I heard that's the clav.
And you, by the way, you kind of alluded to this earlier. The reason why it's called Machine Gun, because that's an instrumental. The reason why that Commodore song is called Machine Gun is because when Berry Gordy heard the clav in it, which was still a new instrument, don't forget, it sounded like weapons, like firing to him. It sounded like gunfire. I think they had another title
machine
in mind,
gun.
But Berry Gordy's like, no, you're calling it Machine Gun.
Well, there are no lyrics, so I was always waiting for them to say Machine Gun. Can I throw in one more? Earlier in the episode, I said that you should never cover Stevie.
Yeah.
But really be scared if Stevie covers you, because he might absolutely steal your fire.
Obliterate your original. Yeah.
He might steal your fire. Speaking of fire, my favorite cover of Stevie covering someone else is The Doors' Light My Fire. He has an amazing cover of Light My Fire, which is so epic. I think it, as much as I love Light My Fire by The Doors, his version, it just sounds very different. It sounds very different. And if you don't know it, go out and check it out. Stevie Wonder, Light My Fire. Amazing cover.
I can very much imagine preferring that over the original. No shade intended, but a little shade intended. Not the biggest Doors fan.
There's only one door left, I think, so you might be safe.
Oh, okay. I think I might be safe from the repercussions of that statement. Okay.
All right, Luxury, help me end this episode.
This is the end of the episode about... It's hard. You know what? Stevie Wonder is a freaking genius. So many reasons. Not the least of which...
I think that's my big takeaway, too.
Not the least of which is like playing that part... And doing anything with your mouth, like to even talk while playing, that is freaking difficult.
That is really difficult.
I cannot do that.
That is really difficult. It's easier to be the resident fascist than the resident clavinet expert.
Literally, all I can do with a clavinet in my mouth is say a sentence with the same notes in the same rhythm. Like that's not useful because that's not what we need here.
May not be the international hit that Tamla needs.
And you know,
Tamla Ricketts needs a hit.
Tamla needs a hit, and it's not that. But what we need to do is end this show.
We do need to end this show.
One of my favorites to tape. I'm going to be honest with you.
It's been a lot of fun.
It's got the Stevie slop all over it, and I love it. But you know who I am? Because I'll tell you.
Who are you?
I am producer, DJ, and songwriter Luxury. Who are you?
I'm actor, writer, director, and sometimes DJ D'Ello Riddle.
And this is One Song. We will see you next time. We will see you next time on One Song on Sirius XM. Kevin Hart.
One Song is a Sirius XM and Kevin Hart's LOL Radio production. It's hosted by me, Luxury, and my friend D'Ello Riddle. This episode was produced by Matthew Nelson and Jordan Colling, with engineering from Marcus Hom. Additional production support from Leslie Guam, Charles Childers, and Alicia Shimada. The show is executive produced by Kevin Hart, Ty Randolph, Mike Stein, Brian Smiley, Eric Eddings, and Eric Weil.
Is this house a good price compared to others in the area? Are prices going up or down? If I don't make an offer right this very moment, will I miss my chance? These are just some of the questions a home buyer might ask. And these are the sorts of questions an agent who is a Realtor can help answer. Because Realtors have the expertise, data, and access to specialty training to help you navigate the process of buying a home. They provide support, guidance, and have your back every step of the way. That's what Realtors do, because that's who we are. Realtors are members of the National Association of Realtors.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.